sat on their park bench like bookends. A newspaper blown through the grass falls on the round toes of the high shoes of the old friends. Old friends, winter companions, the old men, lost in their overcoats, waiting for the sunset. The sounds of the city sifting through trees settle like dust on the shoulders of the old friends. Can you imagine us years from today, sharing a park bench quietly? How terribly strange to be 70.
Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday. One of the people in that song, Paul Simon, turns 70 in 2011. And I was captured by Ringo Starr's 70th birthday last week, seeing him on television, thinking, how could anybody 70 years old look so absolutely fabulous and be involved in this peace song all throughout the world? The New York Times had an interesting piece on Sunday that caught our attention. Turn 70, act your grandma's age. And our guest this hour, who is from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, said in the article, it's either the stories of young onset Alzheimer's or it's the skydiving grandmas. We don't hear enough about the huge middle, which is the vast majority of folks. It is amazing how many people have turned 70 or will in 2010 and how many in 2011 and 12. Alex Trebek is 70, Al Pacino, Barney Frank, Chuck Norris, Nancy Pelosi, Pele, Raquel Welch, Ted Koppel. Next year, Bob Dylan turns 70, David Crosby, Dick Cheney, Julie Christie, Martha Stewart. Our guest this hour is Professor Ann Basting, the director of the Center on Age and Community and an associate professor in the Department of Theater at the Peck School of the Arts, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, where she teaches storytelling and playwriting. She's written extensively on issues of aging and representation, including a couple books, Forget Memory, Creating Better Lives for People with Dementia, and The Stages of Age, Performing Age in Contemporary American Culture. She was quoted extensively in the article in the Times, and we're happy to have her with us this hour. We also want to have you welcome by phone or by email this morning. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Ann Basting, thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations on being quoted so extensively in the Times article. It was really interesting.
Thanks so much. I felt in very good company. There were some amazing people quoted. It also happened to be right about a week after the passing of Robert Butler, who was a leader in geriatrics and gerontology and a real mentor of mine, so I was honored to be included.
Yes, it was fascinating. And it was precipitated. I think that many people had the same reaction I did when I saw Ringo Starr on his 70th, and my first reaction was, Ringo Starr is 70? And the second reaction was, this guy looks absolutely fabulous. What is he doing? In a way, I'm not 70 yet, but I thought, how in the world could I possibly have that much energy and look that good at the age of 70?
Well, I think, you know, and the list of people that you named as people who are turning 70 or who are 70 already, those are not has-beens. Those are nows. You know, those are people who are we see as being leaders in the arts and culture and politics, and suddenly we realize that 70 means something different to us at this cultural moment.
I thought what you said here is very interesting. It wouldn't do us a whole boatload of harm to reinstate some values to contemplation, which may be one of the things that happens to many people when they turn 70.
Yeah, I think, you know, we have a funny culture where we focus, even our terms for how to consider aging within gerontology are about successful aging or productive aging. It's all, we are a culture of doing and not real good about figuring out the value of contemplation, of thoughtfulness, of considering experience, and of being in the present moment. We zoom by the present moment very quickly. And I think that's something that we need, that can help us even bring more value to late life, is to find that value in contemplation and being and passing, really fully experiencing the moments that we do have left.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's something to be said for telling Ringo and Paul Simon, and I guess I mostly think of performers here, not politicians, because many of them are older, to exit the stage?
You know, I think we're witnessing a really interesting time. First, we've never lived this long with this great amount of health. Now, at the same time, we've also never lived this long with this much frailty. I mean, we're seeing a double edge here coming mm-hmm. through the baby boom as they get older. And that's that we're going to have drastic increases in frailty, and we're going to have drastic increases in, I mean, you've probably heard the dementia and Alzheimer's numbers that are just going to, put us agape. We're going to be really astounded by the cultural changes that's going to bring. But I think what we're going to see, also because of the downturn in the economy, we're going to need to work longer. We're going to see this separation between aging and frailty. If you are disabled, then we need to find a way to support you and to help you ease into retirement. If you're not disabled and you want to stay engaged and keep working, whether that's volunteering or paid work, then we need to help support you to do that. So I think the exit the stage thing is changing drastically.
Well, it's also interesting how these people have stayed on the stage for such a long period of time and seem to be embraced by a younger generation as well. Sometimes when I see people like Mick Jagger or some of the other rock and roll performers who continue to perform into their 60s and 70s, I'm thinking, why is it that we concentrate so much on that particular generation? It seems to me to the expense of other generations. And I'm a member of that generation.
I think in some ways they defined the movement of rock and roll. I mean, you know, we have to go back to the blues roots and then the Elvis extravaganza and, you know, the explosion of it in that way. But, you know, 1968 was a huge turning point for the world, and the formation of this movement and the baby boom reaching their young adulthood, and it was a phenomenal time period, and we see them as cultural icons. Now, the thing that's going to be interesting is to see how we allow them to grow, or whether we simply keep requesting the oldies. You know, that's a big thing. Are we going to allow, take the Rolling Stones. Charlie Watts has white hair. Mick does not. Mick defines himself on a certain ability to move and shake. And Charlie does not. You know, I'm the chair of the Humanities and Arts Committee for the Gerontological Society of America, and every year we show a film. And last year we showed Shine a Light, because I see it as, which is a Martin Scorsese documentary on the Rolling Stones.
Mm-hmm.
And I see it as such an icon for how we look at what baby boom means and what we're going to allow. It's a real discussion between Ronnie Wood and Mick Jagger and Charlie Watts about who we were when we started this whole crazy thing and who we are now and how we're going to be allowed to age in the eyes of the public.
Hmm. How much time do we have left now on average after 70?
I think we're up toward the mid to the late 70s, early 80s now. And, you know, you just cross your fingers and hope that you can make it through without considerable frailty and disability. That's the real difference in the quality of aging. My work has, for the last 15 years or so, has really centered on how to recuperate the quality of life, even for those people who do encounter disability. And for me particularly, I work in dementia and Alzheimer's. So even if that happens, it's not the end of your life immediately. and how can we recuperate quality of life for people who do encounter frailty?
It was interesting to me, though. I thought the numbers would have been much higher. When you look at this Times article, the number of people who have high blood pressure is way up there. But heart disease is not huge. Diabetes isn't hitting what I thought would be maybe a majority of people who are 70 and above. Stroke, not all that much. Depression, not all that much. When do these diseases really hit us?
It's not my total area of expertise, but my knowledge about Alzheimer's is we are getting around 50% once you're past 85.
I see.
So that's the later you get up into a horrible category they used to call the old, then you're really looking at some higher numbers. I think, though, that we are in some serious danger, though, of creating a generation about two generations from now, maybe the millennials, that we're going to see a totally different picture because of childhood obesity.
Right.
And we have some serious work to do to change that.
Mm-hmm. Who was it? Gloria Steinem quoted in this article when she turned 70, said that all of a sudden mortality really hits, which I imagine it does at 70.
Well, I think we're a spoiled country in that way. I think that you talk to some soldiers in Iraq, they smell mortality every day. And you talk to a generation of the greatest generation, as they're called, and mortality was a different thing for them. There's a generation that's Gloria's age now, and probably the next couple generations that have postponed mortality, associating it with the very late life. But I think it would do us all a lot of good to remember that. Mortality can touch us at every moment, which, would do a great deal to make us think again about the value of late life.
When we focus on those who look so terrific at the age of 70, one of the people in the article said, if we don't pay attention to the dark side of our 70s and 80s, we're not going to pay enough attention to the people who need help. Do we run that risk, and are we doing that now, glorifying those who look fabulous and not looking at those who may need help?
Well, I think that's the pull. This is where it helps that I'm in storytelling and creative writing and do a lot of analysis of the media coverage of late life. Because media coverage and the stories that we tell pull us toward the extremes. So as I said in the article, I think one of the things we do is gravitate toward the crisis. So you hear this, alarm bell of generational warfare. We're going to all go bankrupt. What are the other ones? We're all going to have Alzheimer's. It's going to bankrupt the whole country. And the stories go toward the crisis, or you go toward the story of the inspirational exception, and that is the. I remember in the Milwaukee airport, I passed by this big poster, and there's a picture of a gray-haired, really cut gentleman water skiing, and plan for your old age. Invest now, and this can be you. And so I think, we tend toward either the crisis stories or the exception stories. And, the human interest of someone in their, 80s, who has maybe early stages of memory loss, but who is volunteering at Habitat for Humanity and having a meaningful life, we don't necessarily hear those as much. And that's where the real richness to mine, images of aging and examples of positive aging.
Our guest this hour is Professor Ann Basting, Director of the Center on Age and Community and an Associate Professor in the Department of Theater at the Peck School of the Arts, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, where she teaches storytelling and playwriting. We're talking about turning 70 and looking at the people. It was inspired by Ringo Starr turning 70 last week and absolutely looking wonderful. Do we run the risk of not paying enough attention to those people who may be struggling the darker side of being 70 rather than get on the stage and rock and roll. And it is amazing the number of well-known figures who I grew up with who are turning 70 this year. We welcome your participation in the show. It would be nice to hear from some of you who have turned 70 or are about to turn 70. We'd like to hear your thoughts about the attention we paid to glamorous people who have turned 70. Does it set the bar way too high? 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. We're talking about turning 70 this hour of the program, and our guest is giving us valuable information about turning 70 and what we need to look at as a society in terms of what's more common when we turn 70, and it's not for many of us rock and rolling into our 80s. Our guest is Professor Ann Basting, Director of the Center on Age and Community, Associate Professor in the Department of Theater at the Peck School of the Arts, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and she is featured pretty prominently in this article in the New York Times in the Week in Review section on Sunday. Here's our phone number. Please join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And let's start some calls here with Donald from Madison. Hi, Donald.
Hi. I'm going to turn my radio off here.
Okay.
Okay, there. Well, I told your answerer that sometimes it's a little embarrassing because, I mean, it's like I want to show somebody my driver's license. They don't want to believe me because I never lie about my age. I turned 70 in February, and I had a big birthday party, and it was swell, and, you know, I have a big family, and, you know, I mean, it was really nice on the one hand, but, I mean, people keep commenting on, well, gee, you know, is 70 the new 50, you know?
You sound very vital.
Well, I am. I have a great life. I can't attribute it to anything. I've taken vitamins for, you know, probably the last half of my life or more, but, I mean, golly, so do other people. And it's just, you know, it's a gift in a way. And I've had my challenges. I've had, some surgeries and stuff, but, you know, basically from the neck up, you know, I look pretty good. I get up in the morning and I know how old I am.
Professor Basting.
Well, I think it's an example of just counting your blessings, truly. Health is everything at this point, and it makes a huge difference. And also, I should add, class, people's financial ability to support themselves through the health issues and maintaining a relatively stable quality of life. It makes a huge difference of your experience of late life. I was also going to mention that my folks are nearing 75, and they head out on a canoe trip in a couple weeks. And also I heard from a friend of mine who's at University of Wisconsin-Madison, now retired, who's 75 and just heading out to Pakistan on a Fulbright.
Oh, my.
So, you know, we're witnessing some incredible things. People aren't without health issues, though, and challenges. I mean, significant challenges, but there definitely is something that we're able to experience life longer and more fully.
Mm-hmm. And how do you deal, Donald, with the fact that, you know, unless you're some kind of miracle, you don't have as much time left as you've already had, that you're entering a later phase of life?
Well, I've had a couple of, near-death experiences to where, for example, when I was 59, I was told that I had cancer of the gallbladder, and so I knew it was the end. And as it turned out, when I woke up from the surgery, all the prayers helped and made it go away in the way I look at my world. And so, But, you know, I actually accepted. Nobody else wanted to accept it, of course. My wife and my kids are all very, very, devastated that, you know, this was most likely the end of my life. But I was accepting of it because I was powerless, you know. So, but when I woke up, you know, and found out that, I was going to be okay, well, you know, I counted my blessings for sure.
Right, I'm sure you did.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your call. Is that an issue that a lot of people confront? I know people are confronting friends of mine when they turn 50 these days or when they turn 60 that you don't have as much time. And so you are, Bob Dylan is a case in point. He's been obsessed with this issue. I mean, Woody Allen, not Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan talks more about aging, but Woody Allen's been doing films on this forever. But there does come a point, and it seems to me as though 70 may be that point, where you might have some angst about dying.
Well, I think it's true. I think, though, that there's been some interesting studies done on fear of dying. In psychology, sometimes they look at it through something called terror management theory, that things that terrify us, how we manage those fears. And some of that research has been done by university researchers, and they are asking, of course, the people they have most access to, which is young people. Their fear of dying is huge because they have a long life ahead of them, and it would feel unnatural and premature to do it. When they start looking more deeply into older people and surveying older people's responses, it's an interesting shift that happens, which is that I think that it's less of a fear of mortality than a fear of meaninglessness.
Oh.
And that you're seeing when you work more with older people, that the fear centers more on, my life hasn't meant anything. I'm not part of the world anymore. The fear becomes centered on, as I said, meaninglessness and not having a value or a purpose in the world. And I think that there's a cascading element to that, that when you start feeling a sense of meaninglessness or disconnectedness, that your health can deteriorate more rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting studies that has come out recently is that having a sense of purpose is preventative for dementia.
Interesting.
So, you know, my theory was, let's take 1% of all of the pharmaceutical research and 1% for purpose. Let's start finding, you know, purpose for people in their midlife and late life so that we can help avoid some of the dementia.
I think that's a wonderful idea.
I thought so, too.
Yes, it is. Let's go to Anna from Madison. Hi, Anna.
Hi, dear.
Hi.
I have two
We're having a hard time hearing you, Anna. Can you get a little...
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear... Is this better?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry about that. First of all, I did read that article with great interest and really appreciate you following up on it. That's wonderful, because it was really fascinating to me, too. I wanted to say quickly that I believe the secret to eternal youth is having your kids late, because I had mine at 40 and 43, and I feel I'm 10 years younger, I think, than most of the people my age. I'm 48 now. But the other thing, I'm a musician in Madison, not famous at all, like the Rolling Stones, but performed a lot and kind of made a career with the band I was with for 15 years, you know, shimmying about in prom dresses and getting all dressed up and really going over the top. And I really reached a point as I approached 50 where I looked at myself and said, baby, you got to get out of the prom dress. and I've really been thinking about, you know, about how, as a, you know, somebody who on a very minor level is a public figure, how aging is something that you manage as a performer. And I've actually, in my own case, I started a new band, which allowed me to not wear prom dresses, but to really, you know, to kind of take the persona that I had developed and, you know, reinvented as an older, still fabulously glamorous, persona. So I'd be interested in hearing your guest comments.
Well, I want to know, what do you wear, Anna?
Well, I have gone from prom dresses to a page boy beehive wig and retro kind of glamorous clothes with looking like some kind of washed up 1960s lounge singer.
Professor Beeston.
I love it. I absolutely love it. I think, you know, there's a whole other angle to the Ringo Starr article or issue of him turning 70, which is one that you really bring up, and I appreciate it so much. And that's that, you know, we're a lot of the people that we're talking about, and Kathleen, that you mentioned that you gravitate toward, are more performers. And there's something about the fact that they're not on a regular retirement timeline. Hmm. In fact, you don't have to. You know, for the Gerontological Society in meeting in November in New Orleans, we're lining up Nick Spitzer to talk, to also bring in the oldest performing working jazz musician in New Orleans, who's 99 years old.
Oh my gosh.
And he says he can't make any promises. He's not going to be able to show up. But, you know, nobody is going to tell the famous artists like Louise Bourgeois, right? Or some of the... they're in their late years, and no one is going to kick them to the curb because they're creating and performing and doing their craft outside of the usual retirement regime. And you can continue to grow in the arts. It's a beacon, I think, that older people are gravitating toward as a place where they can find meaning, purpose, self-expression, and community. And, of course, I'm passionate about it because that's my area of research. But I think that's also what's behind the figures that we keep pulling out. You know, when I was talking with Kate Zernicke, the New York Times writer, who I think did a fantastic job with that article.
It is. It's really... It's
very
get your attention.
And mm-hmm. thoughtful. I said, you know, nobody's writing about the former CEO of such and such a corporation that retired and is now doing something, you know, in his retirement. They're not, even if it's a meaningful thing. It's when you're retired. From the traditional timeline, from the traditional work field. You know, it's normal. You go off and do something else. But in the creative arts, you can continue to grow.
Let's go next to Bill from Elroy. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to. I'm going to turn 70 in February, and I just, one of the things I noticed is, for example, I have a neighbor who's 40, and I says, well, when are you going to get married? And she says, oh, that'll be another 10 years or so. Or my daughter, who just gave birth to our fifth grandchild, who happens to be a son, which I'm very happy about, but she's 40. And I've noticed that kids wait a long time before they get married. Like my wife and I, we got married at, you know, she was 21, I was 25. Well, our kids get married in their 30s. So.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like things get pushed out further as life expectancy is longer. And I mean, my daughter, I mean, I was really amazed. I mean, she gave birth to a 10-pound, 8-ounce boy, and she is a petite. I mean, she's not a big woman, you know. So and she's very healthy. She's not overweight. So we can, if we choose to have a healthy lifestyle, and given the what's available to us, and really live a healthy life past our, you know, retirement age, and not only that, the retired. I mean, if you, unfortunately, we don't plan well, most of us, you know, for our retirement, so we're forced to keep working, you know, even if we're not artists and writers and politicians,
mm-hmm.
but it takes a little more thinking ahead, and I think the key thing to longevity is to stay in touch with the community, to be connected.
Right. Thank you so much for your call. He makes an interesting point that we are pushing everything back, so obviously that would have ramifications for aging, right?
I think that. What we're seeing is a disruption of the boxes of life that we used to have education, you know, childhood, education, work life, retirement. And that was actually stabilized just kind of, you know, in the early part of the 20th century. And now we're really seeing that disrupted. There's a lot of cultural class differences for when we have children. But with family planning abilities, with education, we're able to postpone having children if you have the economic means to do that, especially if with increases in fertility challenges and being able to, and I'm not saying that was in this case, but in some cases you have to have access to you know, fertility help and the economic issues that that entails to be able to have children later in life. So we're not seeing those boxes in their regular order anymore. Middle-aged people, which I should say too, we're facing a very serious. Let's remember, we're in a really serious economic problematic time. The first people to go are the highest earning people, often, and those people are in their 50s and having to go back to school.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also hardest for them to get rehired. So we're in a really, we can't just gloss over the challenge of the midlife as well. But so we're seeing people in school and retraining for jobs at all parts of their lives now. People going back after retirement from one career to retool for a whole another career, which is very exciting, I think. And that continued engagement. And I have to say, when I jotted down some notes for our conversation today, I wrote social connectedness and underlined it four times.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I personally just think that's everything. That we're seeing the ability for people to stay active in their community, to go back to school, to try these new things, to stay challenging their minds, and making more choices about when they do things.
Let's go to Lynn next. Lynn is joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. So glad you could take my call. And I've been listening to this conversation. I have a couple of things to say. I'm 65. I have had a brain injury at a craniotomy with a subdural hematoma, pretty large one. So that was on the right side. And so as a result of that, I'm living in an apartment complex. It's not assisted living, but it's for people over 62 or people who are disabled. So I see, they call me the kid here because I see many, many of the other residents in their 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our oldest resident is 99. A couple things I want to say, first of all, about the music thing. Music engages about four parts of the brain, and both right and left hemispheres. And so there's a kind of activity, just simply being a musician, that many other people do not get a chance to experience. And the kind of eye-hand-body-heart coordination that has to happen to be a musician, I think that alone keeps the brain so active. And, of course, it's so spiritually fulfilling to be a musician that that gives us an impetus to keep going on because that is so satisfying. But it is also the brain connections. So when I had my brain injury, thank God my musical ability was only diminished slightly. So with people with brain injuries, they don't look like they're sick. They're just sick on the inside. And I have to live with some of those things. I will stutter. I will have periods of great stuttering, and I can't find nouns and all that sort of thing. But basically, I think, well, what the heck? You know, I kind of had that before. But what I'm seeing in my community is that, number one, when people lose the ability to drive their cars, their quality of life goes down precipitously. I hear a lot of the residents say, well, you know, I was driving then. And and a number of them are in walkers, et cetera. So you were talking about that frailty, and that's there.
Mm-hmm.
But the other, it's very interesting with the other residents. I think education has one thing to do with it. Green Bay is full of elderly, you know, people over 70 and 80. A number of them, if they've been farmers or small town people or workers in the mills, very good at their jobs. They found great meaning in that kind of work. Many of them did not have or were not interested in going on to education beyond high school.
Let's get a response here because we have a lot of other callers. Professor Basing.
I agree that music is a really powerful thing. I think we are just now starting to see more research dollars being invested into understanding what is valuable about music and dance, which is also shown to be very powerful for the mind and the body together. Visual arts, you know, all kinds of different things. And I think underneath it all is the complexity of what they're doing, of what people are engaging in, and also that magical social connectedness and purposefulness. That those are the things that keep us active and our minds growing. We now know a lot about plasticity of the brain, that we can actually grow new neurons, that we can expand the capacity of the brain, and that's really exciting research. I think that Tom Cole, who's a friend and mentor of mine, who was also quoted in the New York Times article, his whole book, The Journey of Life, it talks really about this tendency we have, even if it's kind of subconscious, to say, well, you know, it's something that we did or something that we didn't do if we end up with a frailty, a disability in late life. And we have to be really careful about that and instead look at how we can increase and improve the quality of life from wherever that person is, whatever frailty or disability that person has. You know, how can we embrace them and help them be part of the community?
This hour of our program, Ringo Starr turned 70 last week. That prompted a talk show. Our guest, Professor Ann Basting, Director of the Center on Age and Community, Associate Professor in the Department of Theater at the Peck School of the Arts, University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee.
Tied through my ears, rolling high and mighty traps, pounced with fire on flaming roads, using ideas as my maps. We'll meet on edges soon, said I, proud neath heated brow. Ah, but I was so much older than I'm younger than that now.
Time goes by, suddenly your eyes are no the blink of an eye. 67 is gone, the sun is getting high. We're moving on. I'm not denying for a moment. I'm dying for just another moment, and I'm just dreaming, counting the ways to where you are. 15, there's still time for you.
We're talking about turning 70 this hour of our program with Professor Ann Basting. And welcoming your phone calls. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to join us. The number is 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Let's go to another phone call. It's Arlene calling us from Oshkosh. Hi, Arlene.
Hi there. Professor Basting, I want to congratulate you on your positive attitude even after working with Alzheimer's. I am 74 years old, and upon turning 70, I had found that the social pressures were great as far as pulling you down. And so I work very hard to stay positive as you are working in the arts. I love to write. At this time in my life, I am going through a crisis, but I keep all this in mind that you have spoke on, and I would love to see some of your plays because I do feel that that is such positive feelings when we can do something in the arts. And that is the one reason why I retired here in Oshkosh. I am a Chicago native, but I love it here with the university and the music. And I just want to congratulate you and thank you for your work.
Well, thank you so much. Actually, I should say that the first piece play that I produced from a creative storytelling project that I did that's still going on, it's called Time Slips, which does creative story, improvisational storytelling with people with really middle to late stages of Alzheimer's. The first play we produced was at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh. It was my first teaching job out of my PhD, yeah.
Oh.
And we've gone on and then done them in Milwaukee and New York, and they did a play up in the Door Community Auditorium, and so they've been done around. I should say a project that is actually starting now and is really going into full gear in the fall is called the Penelope Project, which is we're going to have discussion groups about the myth of Penelope from Homer's Odyssey.
Oh.
Guided by UWM students, and the conversations will be with older adults who live or visit, or the staff of Luther Manor, which is here in Milwaukee. In independent living, assisted living, day center, and the nursing home, the health center. And then we're collaborating with a theater company, Sojourn Theater, and we're going to draft a script. And the folks who live and work there are going to help us develop the script, and we're going to do a site-specific performance of a play inside Luther Manor and invite the public to come see it.
Oh, wonderful.
Production.
Wonderful. Let us know about that, please.
Yeah,
that would be great. Well, talk about a sense of purpose. If your body holds up, you're going to go a long time, right? which does, you know, this is kind of minor in our discussion, but I got to tell you, if Ringo Starr wrote an article about why I look this good at the age of 70 and you plastered his picture on some magazine, I'd buy it. What's the secret to that?
Well, you know, I think there's who knows what secrets he holds. You know, there's a lot you can do that involves either a little bit of help from, you know, some surgeons and some hairstylists.
Exactly.
Or there's really good living, you know, and there's exercise, which we still know to be the very best thing for you. And there's eating right, which now we understand to help pretty much everything from cancers to heart disease to dementias. And there's staying socially engaged and having a meaningful life. It really boils down to those things.
Let's go next to Rose from Blanchardville. Hi, Rose.
Hi. I don't think the medical profession has caught up with the exuberance of older people. I think when you go in there and they look at your age, I think you're kind of like shuffled through. I'm 76, and there was a medical error that was performed on me about 7-8 years ago, and I have lost the use of my left arm. And I have to, I have to find out what's out there for people like me. And then I tell my doctor about it. And then he says, oh, okay. And then, of course, you're denied by your insurance company. And then you have to check to make sure your doctor's going to fight for you. And then you finally do get something. And it's just like one time after another that I expected to work, actually. I used to work at Land's End for, into my 90s. I mean, I still have dark hair. I jump on my trampoline. I mean, I go for walks. I mean, I am just out of, when I see people, and I think part of it, is keeping your mind active. I've always been active. You know, my husband and I started the marriage encounter in the Archdiocese of Chicago in 69. So, I mean, there were things that we've always been involved in, and I think that's what keeps people young. Don't you?
As I've said, I think I underlined social and connectedness and meaningfulness 4 times. I think that's the key to everything. And I think that we can do that all the way through to the last moments that we are breathing. all the way through, that growing never stops. And the real tragedy is when we give up on the fact that we can grow and change.
I want to talk a little bit about the term that your mentor, Dr. Butler, coined when he coined the word ageism. Do you think that, and that was back in 1968, do you think that there is a lot of that still in society, and how would it manifest itself?
I think that it may have, it evolves, and it has different guises. I do think we still have it. I think it's probably, you know, something we'll have to wrestle with for a long time. It's like a lot of the other isms are the same way. I'm sure you had a similar discussion about racism and after Obama was elected, are we in a different moment? But we always have it. It just changes guises. With ageism, I think that if you visit a nursing home and it's a place that is, if it happens to be a place that is void of meaning, and people are really isolated, and it's the image you might conjure of a real nightmare image, I think that's ageism. And I think that our policies and our culture that allows that to happen are ageist. Hmm. The fact that we don't have a long-term care policy in this country is part of that. I think our fears that we have sometimes of not wanting to go visit a friend who has dementia, or not being able to summon the emotional courage to go do that, has a tinge of that as well. Let alone these things where the people who are in late midlife, you know, this blurry time period between what we call old age and midlife now, that they can't get work is part of ageism, that it's very hard to find work if you've been let go at that time of your life. You know, they're all aspects of it. And the incredible pressures of physical appearance that we would want to or have to feel as though we have to color our hair or get plastic surgery or work out like excessively in the gym because our value of our bodies, particularly for older women, I think, are in their body or their appearance is ageism.
Well, that was a great answer. It was. It was really good. I'm glad I asked that question. Let's go to Richard from Ernie, Wisconsin. Hi, Richard.
Good morning. Good morning. The first thing to say is they're not taking me without a fight.
I can hear it in your voice, Richard.
Thank you very much. And I just returned from travel to Iceland, Finland, and Estonia. I participated in a ceramic conference in Estonia. And when I came from Minneapolis, if I turned right, I would have gone home. So I turned left and went up to Bayfield and went to tent show and saw on Friday night the Avett Brothers.
Oh, yeah.
It was incredible. It was fantastic. And then the next night I had some time and I went to see Riding the Wind. And, you know, there were a lot of old people there. And it was an entirely different thing. But the thing to say is I'm changing. I'm reinventing myself, which is a common way to look at it now. But at age 60, I retired from my university teaching job and came home. And after a while, I got a little bit bored. So I took training as a CNA. And for the last 8 years, I've been working. I'm the oldest active CNA working in Wisconsin or Minnesota, male. And so what happened there was so fantastic because I used to be never afraid of death, but afraid of dying, and now I'm not. And I'm looking at those old people, understanding the process, the aging process, knowing this is coming for me, and now I have sort of a management plan in place. And it's been fantastic. So I'm headed out to the studio. Now I've got two kilns to build out here, and I got some clay to turn into pottery. So I got to get going here. I'm busy, you know.
Well, thank you,
Richard.
Add
to your list that you should let people know about your process of becoming a CNA and that it's meaningful work, because I personally, as you can probably tell by the fact that I work with people with dementia and a lot of work in nursing homes,
right.
I think it's some of the most meaningful work you can do. And, you know, the Buddhist tradition is that, I'm not Buddhist, but I know from Zen Hospice that accompanying the people through dying is the highest honor you can have. And we allow our fears to overcome us in that situation. And it's really a tragedy that we aren't focusing on the growth of that that can happen and the learning that can happen accompanying people through that process. Mm. It's an incredible thing.
Thank you so much. Work. Thanks for the call, Richard. That was perfect. And Professor Ann Basting, thank you so much for all of your wisdom this hour. Thanks.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, happy to have you here. She is director of the Center on Age and Community, associate professor in the Department of Theater at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Thank you, Rhonda Fanning, for producing this hour and running the board here as well. Chrissy Pease, thank you so much for all the music production and answering phones. And thanks for your calls, everybody.
It's much better by far to be young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive just by being alive. Now here is the best part, you have a head start if you are amongst the very young at heart.